Thank you for coming to this session. This is a follow-on session or a follow-on talk from a session I participated in yesterday about disasters. And at that time, I talked about the effect of a natural disaster on our wet lab, which we have at the School of Nursing. And not to be outdone by Dr. Hahn, we also have paid political announcement. There are faculty openings we have at the School of Nursing, and you'll find the flyers on the back table. So I think all schools of nursing are recruiting. But what I want to talk about today is the effect of a natural disaster on research with a low-income population. And this is supported by funding from NINR. I have a R21 proposal, and you can see with my low-income, and I recruit from low-income populations for this study, for this research, and then when we have a hurricane, it has a strong effect on it. These are my co-researchers, and Jacqueline Johnson and Maria Renovato are my research assistants. Okay. Hurricane Ike came ashore September 13th, 2008, with the epicenter at Galveston, Texas. And the eye crossed right over. You can see that it was a huge hurricane all the way from, you know, halfway into Louisiana, all the way down to Victoria, and the path went up by Dallas. And so I wish we had a pointer, because that sort of little black curvy thing in the middle is Galveston Bay, and it went right over Galveston Bay. And what created so much difficulty from the hurricane was the storm surge. The winds were about almost a Category 3, but we had a Category 5 storm surge. Because since Galveston is an island, and from the 1900 storm, a 17-foot seawall was built along the side of the island that faces the Gulf, because that's what happened with the 1900 storm. The Gulf came in and swamped the island. But this time, what happened was that it was a slower-moving hurricane with high winds, and so it generated so much water push that went up into the bay, and then with the circular winds from the hurricane, it pushed all that back onto the island. And so we had the storm surge from the bay side where there was no seawall. And so the bay side water is what swamped the island. And so it wasn't from the seaward side, it was from the bay side. And the bay side is where we have a lot of the oil refineries, and so we, you know, some of the water was really, really dirty and polluted and oily, and that's what covered the island. Okay. You can see that it brought a wall of water over 13 feet high, sweeping through Galveston. It made landfall with sustained winds just a 1 mile an hour short of a Category 3. It really just, I think 80% of the island was covered, and it's hard to find the places in the island that weren't covered by Ike. Some of those were just individual pockets behind the seawall, and were, you know, just a few blocks at a time kind of place that weren't covered with dirty water. And this is just a picture of what it looked like before. On the left, you can see what the blue-green areas, vegetation and everything like that. And then on the right, you can see all of that was areas that was covered by water. And so it was pretty much devastated. The area that's to the upper left corner, that's what we call the mainland. And the Galveston County actually consists of part of the mainland along with the island. And a lot of people live on the mainland that were greatly affected by Hurricane Ike, because there's a lot of low-lying areas in the mainland, and a lot of the areas, some of those are expensive vacation homes, but a lot of them are more what we used to call fish camps, where there are some low-income people who, you know, have small little places, and they support themselves through fishing. It's very, very common when, you know, driving along that area to see people just on the side of the road fishing out of the bay, and that's how they support themselves and their family, by eating the fish that swim in these waters that are heavily polluted. So we need more environmental health impact studies of this. Okay, this just shows the path of Hurricane Ike. It went, you know, right through Houston, and then turned and went a little to the east of Dallas, and areas all along there were affected at different levels depending on the how high the winds were. I know areas of Houston were without power for 3 to 4 weeks because the winds knocked down so many trees, which knocked down the power lines, and this was in September, so there was no air conditioning, and ice was like gold. I mean, everybody wanted ice, and so, you know, people were without power, without any kind of electricity, with gasoline stations ran out because people were trying to use generators, and then they would use generators in their home, and they'd have carbon monoxide poisoning, and on and on. So the environmental impact of large disasters really is significant. This is a typical house in Galveston. After the floodwaters receded, people would go to their went back to their homes, and they found that it was covered with several inches of sludge and nasty, toxic sludge. And they did analysis of this sludge and found a whole lot of heavy metals in it. And so many homes had to be just totally rehabbed. I've talked to friends who had 12 feet of water in their homes, and they've had, you know, they were just like, Ike was a little over 2 years ago, and so they have just been able to get back in their homes like in the last five months. Because they were so damaged, they had to be torn down to just the bare studs and then rebuilt. And I was talking to somebody the other day. I work part-time in a free clinic like what you were describing, and they were telling me about some people who lived over on one of those areas on the mainland that, you know, I mentioned, who that the house stood through the hurricane. They thought they were doing fine, you know. They came back in. It was up on stilts, so they didn't get any water in their house. They thought everything was great. And then they noticed that their children kept getting sick, you know, with asthma and respiratory problems, et cetera, et cetera. So they finally had an environmental scientist come in and evaluate the house, and he discovered toxic levels of mold, that the water had soaked into the piers, and that had been drawn up into the framework of the house, and so mold was growing in the framework of the house, and they never knew it because they didn't have any water lines in the house. And so they're going to have to completely to gut their house and get rid of all that to get rid of their mold so that the family won't be affected. And the insurance, the government-sponsored insurance to cover damage from the hurricane has expired. It expired at the end of 2 years, so they are going to be facing set thousands of dollars of rehab without any type of recompense for that. But basically, people came back home, threw everything out in the yard. There was Dr. Mendez there. She's one of my colleagues at UTMB, and she drove around and took pictures of the mounds and mounds of trash. We had large city parks that were full, you know, like 20 feet high full of trash. It was just something else. Okay. This is a flooded street on campus. This is what it looked like after the storm cleared. We had lots of water on our campus. Everything on the first floors of all the campus buildings was destroyed, so the cafeterias were out. We had temporary dining tents because, you know, we had no cafeterias, no kitchens. They would truck food in from places and people would just eat in the tent. So my research, what was my research about? I do studies on the effect of interventions with families with low-income children in the WIC program, Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, on childhood obesity, child nutrition, breastfeeding, failure to thrive, those areas. And so my current study is an intervention study to look at reducing the BMI of children who are in the WIC program. And when I set my study up, I had four WIC clinics, two on the island, two on the mainland, so they were matched, and so I could do a quasi-experimental design. And I partnered with the Galveston County Health District. That's the agency that sponsors the WIC clinics. In September 2008, I had just recruited my first subject on September 5th. And so then I hit September 8th, all the WIC clinics closed down, and the population was evacuated. From the island, from the mainland, they all evacuated, they left. The WIC clinics on the mainland reopened within 1 week, but those clinics were all about helping the people who were basically homeless, who didn't have any food, emergency care, and they didn't really have time for researchers in their clinics who would slow down the process. So that basically put a big kink in my recruitment. And just talking about the research staff ourselves, we all lived on the mainland, but we had family on the island. Not all of us, but many of us did. The research assistants evacuated out of town, but I live on the mainland, so I stayed in sheltered in place, as they call it. Everybody, all of us, had our homes damaged, and some of them had damage too severe to live with. One of my research assistants had to go move in with her family, who lived about 100 miles away, and because her house was so damaged, and she was renting and just didn't have the insurance to get it repaired, and it took her months and months to try and get her house repaired. So we did a lot of ad hoc kind of planning meetings, and we really had to figure out what to do, you know, to keep the research going when our population had left. This is a picture out of my backyard. 8 hours before the Ike hit, you can see the wind with the trees blowing and the water rising, It got up to the back fence but didn't get into the yard. But that's usually a little bayou that's just, you know, not all that wide. So it pushed all the water in from the bay. And this is a picture of downtown Galveston out one of my friend's windows, who actually stayed in Galveston. I couldn't believe it. And the water was like 20 feet high by her house. And she said, you know, the storm was scary enough to go through with all the wind and all the noise and not knowing what's going to happen. She said when the lights went out and they couldn't see anything, it was dark, and all they could hear was all these, you know, pounding noises. And then when daybreak rose, they looked out and they were totally surrounded by water. There was no access. They couldn't leave their apartment. There was no power, no lights, no water, no sewer. And so the only thing they had was what they had brought with them. So I just wish she hadn't have stayed. That's another view out of her apartment. And this is a large she's on a second story loft. And so these are very old buildings. And so like 20 feet, you know, from the second floor is quite a ways up, but you can see the water was up to there. And then this was her landing. She couldn't go out because, you know, there was water in the streets. So this is another picture. The yellow areas are the flood areas that get inundated, and that's a mandatory evacuation zone. And it just shows the reds are the highways out that people evacuated on. So what I did, Cheryl Bishop, my co-author here, is the statistician on the grant. And so soon after that, she constructed a survey, because one thing we realized right off the bat is that my sample is hopelessly skewed from now on, and so I better, you know, deal with it. And so we set up a little survey that everybody we enrolled, we would see what the effect of Hurricane Ike was on their lifestyle, on their home, you know, because how can you do an intervention about feeding your children when you don't have a kitchen anymore? So we thought we ought to capture some of this data. So we set up this survey, and we basically put it in place in October, you know, the first time we got back in the WIC clinics until October, you know, a year later, so that everybody we recruited during that year, we could say, what did you do during Ike? And we were able to recruit 31 subjects, and they all filled it out. And everybody, of course, is low income, since they have to be to qualify for WIC. Okay. Some of the problems we ran into is the WIC clinics and their clients, you know, the clients for WIC basically all had to move away, had to relocate. Most of them didn't own their own homes. They were renting. One thing that happened in Galveston with the low-income housing projects, there were four of them. They were all flooded because they were on the less desirable land in the island. I don't think that's a surprise to anybody where they put low-income projects. Not at all protected from the water, and so they were flooded. And before the flooding occurred, there was a mandatory evacuation of Galveston, and so everybody who lived in low-income housing was put on buses and, you know, taken away and dropped off in Houston or Austin or someplace else. And they were never allowed to come back to those to their homes, really, because they put a fence around them and then they tore them down. And so all of their possessions, everything was just gone. And most of them haven't come back. Most of the low-income people who lived in those public projects are just gone. And then the subjects we did find in the clinics on the mainland, you know, they were living temporarily with family. They weren't interested in participating in research. Many of the clients we were trying to reach didn't have transportation to get to the clinics. Their cars were flooded. They didn't have any phone service. They were living with relatives, or relatives were living with them. You know, it's just, I guess whenever we think about vulnerable populations, they're vulnerable to everything. And whenever the disaster happens, they're going to be the most vulnerable, and they're going to have the most effects of what happens. So I asked people, you know, where do they evacuate to? And the large majority went with family. I'm sorry, I thought my little graph of numbers would show up on these slides, but it didn't. Technical difficulties. So I'd say about 60% moved in with family. About another 25% moved in with friends. Some went to hotels and some went to shelters. How long were they without power? And these are days. The mean days without power is about 11 days without power. Days away from home, about 14 days away from home. Many of them had to drive for 7 hours to get to where they ended up at. how many other people were in the family, in the family groups. There was about 6 people per family that evacuated. Each of those family groups had about 4 children, and there was about 5 adults. And so, you know, large family groups would all move away together. What kind of damage did they have? Well, home damage. The largest light blue area there is actually the second from the bottom. So I'd say about 40% of people had their homes damaged. And then another 25% registered with FEMA. And then another about 10% got FEMA housing, and about 20% got other kind of FEMA help. We didn't have a whole lot of injured, people who were injured from the hurricane, but we did have a few, about 10%. So the main problem to my research study is, where are my subjects, or potential subjects, I should say. This is, you know, all the low-income housing projects were evacuated, flooded, boarded up, bulldozed. Most of the low-income families have relocated. One of the WIC clinics on the island permanently closed, so, you know, and that was the one at the university, and it was, and it served nearly all of the women who delivered at the university, because we have a very large maternal child subject pool at the university. Many, many patients come to UTMB to deliver. About 8,000 babies a year are born there, and that WIC clinic is closed, so none of those women no longer have services from WIC to the university anymore. Okay, this is a picture of the housing project taken by Dr. Mendias, and this is, it's been evacuated, the waters have come and gone. You can see one tree was pushed over by the wind leaning on the house. This is what it looked like afterwards. Basically demolished, flattened, everything gone, and fenced. You can see how it was fenced, and nobody can get to that. So how do we cope with our challenges of doing research during a natural disaster? Second person I called was probably the WIC director to know what was happening in the WIC clinics and find out how Galveston County was responding. Because, of course, Galveston County, being a health district, a health department, is charged with protecting the health of the population. And so that was their primary importance, and that's what they were looking at, is, you know, food, clothing, and shelter for the everybody who was affected by the hurricane. And the WIC clinics were probably not their top priority. Then I started talking with the Department of State Health Services, and I was able to add a WIC clinic in Houston after 8 months of negotiations with the Texas Department of State WIC services. So it was quite cumbersome. I think I only was able to recruit 5 subjects from the Houston WIC clinic. Plus, my program officer at National Institute of Nursing Research, you know, I was on the phone with them a lot to say, this is what's going on, this is how we're dealing with it, you know, because they were going, so, do you have research anymore? So, coping with the challenges, I kept a copy of all my data with me, and this is very, very important. Any of you researchers, keep copies of all your data with you, your protocol books, your intervention handouts, your questionnaires, everything you're going to need to do your research, have it with you. Evacuate with it. Don't think you'll go back to your office and get it. And then we added the Ike questionnaire so we can measure the impact of a hurricane on our outcomes, especially on parenting and depression. Plus, we had frequent meetings with the research staff and other potential WIC areas, like, you know, the City of Houston WIC program, Texas Department of Health, all of these other areas. So why did we have so much trouble with WIC? Well, excuse me, with Ike. It was so much worse than we anticipated. We really thought we'd be gone 3 or 4 days and would come back. That's what happened before. But instead, Ike was such a devastating storm that we were without power, water, sewer, gas, you know, electricity, much, much longer than anybody anticipated. And the civil authorities made questionable judgments. This is in the words of some people at UTMB, because they didn't, you know, everybody had to leave the island, and then since the university is on the island, they didn't allow the investigators to come back on the island for like 3 weeks. And so all of the researchers who had their research there at UTMB were not allowed to access it. So I was glad I had all my data with me. I didn't have to go back to the office to get it. Okay. Our unofficial motto is that UTMB stops for no storm. Because in 1900, you know, UTMB went through a powerful hurricane that killed over 6,000 people. And this was when University of Texas was only about 8 or 9 years old. And, you know, the question was, well, is it gone? Is it devastated? And so the chair of the Board of Regents of the University of Texas said, the University of Texas stops for no storm. So that's been our motto ever since. Okay. And this is, we have posters in the hallway now, and this is one that was created that people just put together, kind of a montage. You can't see it very well, and I apologize for that, but it does have that "We Stop for No Storm" there. And what people learn from Ike is, "I have learned to leave earlier, plan better, and especially for your pets," because many people had pets they needed to place with them. So thanks to NIH, it allowed for Ike extensions. So I got an Ike extension to my work so I can see if I can, you know, see what comes out of this, because like I said, I do not expect that I'm gonna have the same outcomes I would have had with this study if Ike hadn't happened. But NINR has been very good to me and worked with me a lot, and so I do thank them for that. So now we can all have questions, right?
Oh, okay. Yes. Okay. Yes. And yes. Okay. While all of the panelists are coming to the front to respond to the questions, as a person who is really working in my position, the Office of Minority Health in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and also understanding having lived with disasters, I'm going to ask how many people in this room, because most of you are probably first responders, how many of you have your own preparedness kit at home? Okay, for the rest of you, then I'd suggest that when you return that you cannot respond to others if you don't have your own kit, because you can't think about me or anybody else in your community if you don't have your own kit. And I'm going to use a takeaway message here when I do presentations, you know, now on about emergency preparedness, and that is keep your data with you. So that's the takeaway message. And so I'd like to begin by asking you to entertain any messages, you know, any questions to the panel, but also thank you for coming, and I'd encourage you in anticipation for the 2011 APHA meeting, then I strongly encourage that you submit an abstract to the public health nursing section. Yes, okay, any questions?
I have a question for Dr. Hahn.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
What is your major in nicotine dependence? I noticed it said two, yeah. So what's two mean?
Yeah, the Fagerstrom scale is FNDT. I don't know if you've used it before. It's a very well-known, psychometrically sound, developed by Carl Fagerstrom in Sweden, actually. I'm trying to remember. I think it goes, do you remember, Karen, what the scale is to? I think it's five. I think it's one to five. So the higher the number, the more dependent, I think.
Okay.
I can't remember off the top of my head. Or maybe it's four. Maybe it's one through four. So, sorry. I'm happy to send it to you.
I just thought, is that like a cognitive level or something?
It's self-report. Okay, so it's a self-report, and it's a, I think it's about a six-item questionnaire, and it basically asks, there's certain things that it asks, like when you smoke the first cigarette, when you wake up in the morning, when you're sick, do you smoke? I mean, it's a whole range of questions like that. Yeah, and it's used clinically quite a bit, but it's also kind of the gold standard for research. Of course, the higher the dependence, the more difficult it is to quit. And women typically score higher on that scale because women have a harder time quitting than men, but yet they smoke less. They smoke fewer cigarettes, but they're more dependent. So it's more than you want to know.
Okay, any other questions? Well, I have one. Dr. Mishka, you mentioned you made a recommendation at the end of your presentation. After you conducted your surveys, your study, has that clinic made any changes based on your recommendations?
No, the PHQ-9 is actually a routine screening measure now at that clinic. So every patient that comes in is screened using that tool.
Yeah, and are they able to, because what I really liked about your presentation is that there was a survey done, and as soon as you picked up on that, there were some indications that indicated that there may be some mental health issues there, that they were addressed at that time, because so often we wait until, you know, at another time. And so are they still able to do that? And then the other question, are they using the nursing students? Are they still using those in the clinic?
Yeah, it's still going on. It's not a research study anymore,
yeah.
But it's become common practice.
Okay, and they are using students.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good, good.
Yep.
It's like, yes.
I have another question to lead on to that. So, with healthcare reform and the whole focus on a medical home or health home, you know, there's a lot of talk about integrating mental health, obviously, in primary care, and many places like you have been doing it for a while. But one of the things that I'm concerned about and that I've noticed is that in primary care practices, folks aren't necessarily prepared or comfortable doing mental health, and so then they don't do it.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, I mean, you said that you provide mental health service, so mm-hmm. I guess my question is, do you feel like you have enough providers that are prepared to do mental health? I mean, once you screen, can they do anything about it?
Right, and yeah. I think in this particular setting, yes. I think across the board, probably not. And so I think certainly a lot more needs to be done in terms of, you know, boosting up that part of the education for primary care providers. But hopefully, you know, there's some room for more interdisciplinary collaboration that maybe we can get away from a single primary care provider, you know, providing all of it, and maybe
right.
it's something that, yeah, that it's a team approach.
Yes.
My question is also about this training and thinking for more of a population-focused public health perspective, like what else could nursing students or that clinic be doing in the community to prevent some of these mental health problems?
That's a great question and probably one with a really long answer. yeah, I mean, certainly I think prevention is the key to you know, most of the things that we talk about, and we certainly like to be able to prevent problems before they happen rather than just screen for them. But I don't know, I think that the problem is a really big one when we talk about undocumented immigrants and all of the barriers that they face to trying to make it. So I don't even know where I would start. Does anybody else have a better answer? Because that certainly wasn't a very good one.
Well, it was a
my answer is better, but we do know that there's a high incidence of depression in low income, in some low income people with illness. So, you know, there's a high incidence of depression and chronic illness anyway, and despite these kind of more life challenges. Social justice.
Well, and I guess, yeah, my question was sort of.
Yes, Dr. Riffnight-Snyder, I was going to ask you, once you reconnected with the persons in your study, did you find depression, even though that was not a part of your presentation? I was wondering, and how did you address, would that have affected their responses?
We, among these 31 subjects, there's only been a couple that's, because I had the Beck Depression Inventory as part of my battery of tests, and only about two of the women have scored, you know, even moderately high on that, and we refer them to a mental health counseling agency that's run by the county health department so that there isn't a, you know, problem with getting access to it.
Yeah.
But no, we, I think because so many of these, the women, at least in my study, are connected with families, larger family networks, I think that they are getting a lot of family support. Mm-hmm. And that tends to mitigate that, because we just have not seen that the same level of depression, even though the majority of them are Hispanic, but since they're all getting WIC services, most of them are probably more integrated into the community. I don't think I have the higher level of undocumented. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's also another message, takeaway message from her presentation, and that is that if you're engaged, and since I am from the government and I didn't bring a check with me, I can only bring advice. And that is that you need to keep in contact with your project officer, because they are human people. So whether it's a survey or anything else, that those who are not human, then ask for the supervisors. But but it's very critical to talk to that person, so that they know that there would be an interruption even in services as well as study, and the implications of that, because we certainly in the federal government have really been, everybody has been engaged in understanding emergency preparedness, or I call them natural and human engineered events. And so therefore you have more people in the department who are more sensitive to that issue and the implications of what that means. And especially with Katrina, although Ike was prior to Katrina, I think it really increased that level of awareness about displacement of individuals. Yes, yes. Another question. Well, oh yes.
I'm sorry, just again to kind of get back to the social justice.
Yeah.
That's where it is. When you talk about the women that you were able to follow up with and not having many with significant depression, I think we know from
yeah, right. Yeah,
are probably the ones to be more worried about.
I agree. Right, mm-hmm. Right. And I don't know where they've gone.
Yeah.
I think they're probably in Houston, but it's just gone. It's amazing. Galveston has decreased by over 10,000 people.
Mm.
People just didn't come back, and they were not encouraged. Many of the low income have not been encouraged to come back. There isn't the housing for them.
Yeah.
I guess I was wondering too, did you, and maybe this is part of your research design, did you think about kind of changing the site for your intervention?
Oh, definitely.
Like schools or, other places where people go?
I always work with public health departments, and I like to work with new families, and so, but I am moving into Houston. I'm not going to work in Galveston County anymore. I'm moving into Houston for my research. Because even though they were disrupted with power outages, they didn't have the home destructions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they still had their houses.
Yeah.
I was going to relate to that. What's been your experience working with IRB, with WIC? Did you have to go through the Texas State Department of Health?
Yes. I am an IRB veteran. I'm on our university IRB, and I've gone through the state Health Department IRB, WIC had its own review, each individual county has their own reviews, the university, of course, you have to go through their review. I just find out as early as I can what all the rules are, what all the paperwork is, find somebody I can talk to, and just start plowing through it, just make sure I keep everything in a row, and I keep the, like you said, the important person, contact frequently to make sure I'm doing everything correct. And you can almost always find someone who will be your advocate and help you through these systems. And then you just find that person and give them all the paperwork and give them everything they want in the order they want it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
You just got to work it through. There are no shortcuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A question that I had in terms of your unexpected outcomes in your smoking cessation studies, did that impact any of your future studies or plans in terms of addressing smoking cessation? Because generally our tendency is that if you do smoking cessation, that they should be, ideally, that you should have had a different result in the area that was already identified as smoke-free.
Yeah, no, I think, yes, it has affected. Our next, one of the studies that we're trying to get funding for is to ask what effect do smoke-free laws have on poor families and children, particularly, and we hope to recruit Medicaid populations and do hair nicotine studies to see if, in fact, and also look at the strength of the law, because as I said on there, this one community had a moderately strong law. So I think from a policy perspective, it's not enough just to say, did the law affect behavior, but did the strength of the law affect behavior? So we're hoping to do a design in which we randomly assign counties to perhaps, well, we can't do that, but we're going to have different strength of policy groups and then get data from Medicaid. And the nice thing is we have a nice collaborator who has the Medicaid data set, so we can also look at healthcare utilization in those counties. Because I think, and the other piece is to look at the what cessation services are available, because I think what implications it has is huge, because it's not enough to change policy. I mean, policy is important, but in those very disparate populations, you've got to do more than just that, and you've got to make sure that everyone's on the same page, because I think demand does go up, but then if there's, and the other piece is home. I mean, I'm really curious, you know, they reported they smoked more in the home, but it would be neat to get some environmental marker data and some biomarker data from the children in those homes to verify that, in fact, they're being exposed more in those communities. So, yeah, I think it's exciting. I mean, it's sad news, but on the other hand, it's kind of a wake-up call for those of us that do policy work.
Right.
Because a lot of us that do policy work, it's kind of like a no-brainer. Yeah, people are more likely to quit, but then the people who do that treatment provision need to be in the loop and part of the team, and we need to plan for that kind of over the long haul. Because my guess is we probably did see a little dip in people trying to quit, I bet, although that's beyond the scope of our work, maybe in the first year. But then by the time we studied them 3 years later, there wasn't any difference. And I, you know, there could have been significant relapse in that time. So I think it raises more questions, you know, like research does, right? We do research and we get more questions than we get answers. So, and it kind of fits with some of the emerging science that's coming out all over the world. There's a study out of China, and you know, China has very high smoking rates, but it was a focus group study, so it wasn't well powered or anything, but it was women who lived with men who smoked, and they just anecdotally told the researcher that more, that they noticed that their husbands couldn't smoke at work or in public, but they came home and smoked more in the house. So there's some, you know, there are other little kind of studies that support what we found in a way, but there's a lot of room for more research in the area.
Yeah, so then that brings to almost a recommendation, a policy recommendation in terms of having some cessation programs, you know, in the home.
Yeah, right. As well as I don't know if many of you have followed this, but HUD, you know, Housing and Urban Development, has made a very strong recommendation for years, you know, for public housing to be smoke-free. And a lot of some states are actually, and areas are starting to do that, actually pass policy, either do voluntary or passing laws that require, you know, multi-unit housing to be smoke-free. And maybe that's what we need to do in smoke-free communities, is we need to make sure that the housing authorities are smoke-free, really. And maybe that's another step, that when the law passes either at the state or the local level, let's make sure that the housing, if we know that low-income people are disproportionately affected, then probably less likely to quit. Because a lot of these people may not be working, right? So they may be home on Medicaid, and you know, so they're not affected by the law. Yeah, so they're going to smoke just as much as they did before.
And it may also, you know, impact other populations of all income, you know, economic groups as well. Any other questions? Oh, yes. Go ahead.
Actually, one of my colleagues who's sitting right here, Karen Butler, presented just earlier today, and she's done a lot of work in this part of Kentucky with smoking cessation. And actually, people, hardcore smokers in Appalachia, are just as likely to want to quit. They're just as interested in wanting to quit. And actually, they surprised us in that study, because we did focus groups. They talked, you know, in depth about their experience, and they're very aware of big tobacco. I mean, not necessarily growing of tobacco, but they are mad you know, that they have been targeted by big tobacco. And they talked about that. And kind of as an aside, that study was funded with an earmark from Senator Mitch McConnell's office. And when we were trying to analyze that focus group data, and we put in one of the materials kind of exactly what the person said, and people were a little nervous about using that terminology. But we went back and forth, you know, because of who funded it. I'm kind of going beyond your question. But the point is, I think it's a myth to say that people who live in rural areas don't want to quit, because they do. Mm-hmm. And I think they're just as interested, and they're very aware. They're more aware than you would think of how they're being targeted.
And we have in our area, we have a lot of tobacco also in the Pioneer Valley, a bunch of Massachusetts. There's a lot of migrant workers that do our tobacco, but in the community hospital where I work, surprisingly, a lot of the people, the rural people are like, that's the cost. So that was more of their thing. But I was interested that they were like, we're okay to quit now.
Yeah. Let me just ask a question. When you developed your survey in Spanish, did you develop it, or was it input from the people?
Me?
Yeah, yes.
We use the PH, are you talking about the PHQ-9?
Yeah.
It's been validated in Spanish as well as like 17 other languages. So yeah. We felt safe with it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay. If there are no other questions, do I see any hands? Okay. If there are no other questions, again, I'd like to thank you for coming. So thanks a million, and thanks a million to our presenters.